This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Tom Bullock in for Mike Collins. Mike is dealing with a bout of laryngitis, which makes it a little hard to host a show with Talks in its name. He'll be back as soon as his voice returns. But in the meantime, the local news roundup goes on, and we have a lot to talk about today. The General Assembly is back in session. A federal judge rules on the constitutionality of North Carolina election laws, and the Hornets find their sting. Joining us on our panel today are Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, and Nick Oxner, investigative reporter with WBTV News. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us today are Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of the Cue City Metro, and Hillary Burns, staff writer with the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you both for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. Well, let's start with the start of the short legislative session. Although if past short sessions are any guide, that name may be a bit of a misnomer. And before any gavels were pounded to bring the General Assembly to order, arguably the most powerful Republican in state politics gave a preview of what we should expect. That would be Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger. And Nick, you were at the press conference. So what did Phil Berger have to say?
He basically had to say, one, and let's just get it out of the way now so we can continue on with the rest of today's panel, is that he doesn't want to make any changes to HB2. That was an overriding thing. He was very clear on that point.
In fact, we actually have a section of his speech where he says just that. Let's take a listen.
I am not, as I stand here, ready to say, and I don't know that I would at any point be ready to say that we're going to make any changes. I just don't see the need for it.
And so there you have it. I mean, he said that, and then he didn't take any other questions about HB2, wasn't really interested in talking in it about it. He said, that's what we're going to do. But he had some other very interesting things to talk about. I think the biggest headline for me is that he actually supports Governor McCrory's target of raising the average teacher pay to $50,000 a year. To see him come out and support that proposal from the governor's budget, which we'll get to later, was interesting to me. Also, he was the first to talk about the fact that the members of the General Assembly are probably going to get to some more tax reform this year, where we're raising the standard deduction by about $2,000 for North Carolina taxpayers. And,
yeah. The standard deduction, by the way, is it's one way that they're kind of counterbalancing the fact that they also want to drop corporate income tax and personal income taxes. I believe this year they're trying to get it down to something close to, is it 3%?
For corporate income tax, yeah. I think it's already set to like automatically do that.
Yeah. So let's get into the governor's budget then. So the governor puts out his proposed budget. It, again, is a proposal. Governor Pat McCrory is a Republican. The General Assembly is largely Republican. So what was the response?
Well, I think judging from what I've been hearing, a lot of people like just the basic bare bones of what he's talking about. He's talking about raising teacher salaries, doing, you know, more things for along the mainstream sort of moderate kind of line that people thought they were getting when they elected Pat McCrory governor. The question is, as always, whether or not, you know, the legislature, especially Mr. Berger over in the Senate, are going, how far is he going to go along? And it sounds like, from what Nick was saying from the press conference, that he's a little more agreeable in an election year than he generally is, because usually he's Dr. No, and he just like stamps everything out and says, no, thank you.
And that's why I thought it was so interesting that he came out at that press conference and said, yeah, the $50,000 is a good target, because that's like probably one of the first times I'd ever seen him willingly agree to something that the governor had put forward.
And I think you have to view this entire process through the lens of this being an election year. They need to give Pat McCrory some victory, something that he can go back to voters and say, I've raised teachers' pay, we've lowered income taxes for individuals, whatever. They can't just be no, not in this election year if they expect to have him reelected.
Hillary.
But I've read that teachers still aren't happy. They were aiming for 10%. Is that right? So people I saw are still concerned that teachers still will be leaving the state. It may not even do much.
Yeah, you can make the argument that even what he has proposed doesn't go as far as people like June Atkinson, the state education secretary. I think she's been saying raise it by 10, either 10% or 10,000, but basically to try and get it back to where our average teacher salaries match the Southeastern average, and we still haven't gotten back there yet. And it's going to be a long way to get there.
Well, I'm sorry, Glenn, go ahead.
And I was going to say, while those in education could certainly make a case for that, a 5% raise in this environment is nothing to sneeze at. So I think sure. You will be able to even point to a 5% increase and say there's a victory.
Well, and let me point out the specifics in this plan. Governor McCrory's budget would give teachers on average a 5% raise. In the past, we've obviously seen it geared more towards new teachers. This proposal actually does focus more on experienced teachers. And he would give some other state workers a targeted raise or a one-time bonus averaging 3%. Now, what I was surprised in listening to the already, the committee meetings that have already been held on this budget is both Republicans and Democrats seem to be upset with the idea of giving teacher pay raises, but not to other state workers.
And that's what I was going to jump in and say. You couldn't possibly do a teacher raise at 10% because it seems as though most members of the General Assembly also acknowledge that we need to give other state employees a raise. And so they have this surplus. They don't know exactly how much that surplus is going to be, but everyone thinks there's going to be a surplus. That's where we're going to find the money to give all these people these raises. But there seems to be a very strong sense, at least in the House, that there needs to be an across-the-board raise of some sort for all state employees. And I think that's what's keeping your cap at 5% on the teachers.
But this is the same dynamic that we saw last year between the House and the Senate. When you actually saw the House have their budget include a far more generous pay increase for both teachers and for state employees, and see that die in the Senate until they came down to what they ended up passing last year, is that dynamic still in place, Eric?
I think that's the Senate is always going to be just the way things are constructed right now. The Senate is the more conservative of the two bodies. They're more insulated through gerrymandering and whatever from sort of seeing the blowback of some of their actions, especially when they don't reward teachers, which is, generally thought to be sort of a, broadly popular thing to do, except if you're a fiscal conservative and you want to keep the budget down. So the Senate is generally going to be sort of the last line of defense for fiscal conservatives who want to hold spending down. So I think you're going to see that again. Yeah.
Nick, you're shaking your head.
Well, I think that there is a sense this session that some of the other conservative tax policies and other economic policies that the Republicans General Assembly have implemented over the last, 4 years are starting to work. We have a little bit of extra money. We need to spend it to do something. But again, it's interesting because Senator Berger at his press conference last week was less than fond of an across-the-board pay raise for state employees. But he did acknowledge that we have all these other groups that also need raises. State court judges need raises, all these other folks, in addition to teachers. And so I do think that there's a sense that everyone needs a raise, at least to some extent. And it's kind of the first time that the Republicans are like, well, we actually do need to spend a little bit more money here now that we have it.
Well, we want to, of course, hear from you, from our listeners, as we always do. Send us your thoughts or questions or comments on this week's news on Twitter. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup, or you can find us on Facebook or email us at Charlotte Talks. But let's move on to something else in the legislature that's a little bit more tangible for residents of Charlotte than simply a budget, and that is the I-77 toll lane drama.
Never heard of it.
It's back with a new weird little twist here. We had not one, but two bills introduced this week that would end the toll project. But what seems like would be a moment of bipartisanship is actually not, because you have Charles Jeter, Representative Charles Jeter, a Republican, and Representative Tricia Cotham, a Democrat, introducing two separate bills. So what's the story here? Why are there two separate bills?
It really comes down to funding and how. So both bills have the same end goal, right, is to cancel the I-77 contract. But if you do that, you're going to have to pay Cintra some amount of money. Now, that could be as much as $300,000. It could be as little as $300,000 if you talk to Representative.
Or $300 million.
Yes, that's what I meant.
So somewhere between $300 million and
$1. $300,000, yes. And we'd have no problem here.
$300 million and $10 million. That money's got to come from somewhere. The bill introduced by Representative Charles Jeter from Huntersville is not specific on where that money will come from, and we can get into what the speculation is on that in a second. Representative Tricia Cotham's bill, Democrat, also stops the I-77 toll, calls to cancel the contract, but is very specific that all the money that would be paid to Cintra must come out of the DOT budget.
So let's get into that then. Why the difference in this bill? I know both of these lawmakers have been talking to each other. They both had been pushing for this to end. Why the difference in who picks up the tab?
Yeah, it's an interesting little sort of he said, she said, literally, that it comes down to. They were having these discussions about doing a bill together, apparently. And from what I understand and from what was said to my colleague, Peter St. Ange, at some point it became clear that one of them was a little more specific about wanting to make sure that Charlotte was protected, and that being Trish Cotham, according to Trish Cotham. And they sort of had a parting of the ways at that point, and they wound up filing separate bills. I think the whole thing is kind of a tempest in a teapot, really, because you still got old Senator Berger in the background going, yeah, I'm not interested in any of that, and I'm not passing any bill, so, you know, you guys have fun over there.
It also seems interesting to me, and this is just a hypothetical, but I wonder if, let's say, Charles Jeter's bill would have a slightly better chance of at least being considered, because let's face it, right now, Charlotte and Raleigh, they're not really besties. They're not necessarily getting along, even in what has always been a contentious relationship. This seems like something of a low point. So by insulating Charlotte from picking up the tab, I almost wonder if Representative Cotham's bill is even more dead on arrival than it would seem.
Oh, it is dead on arrival. And when I talked with Representative Jeter about this on Tuesday at the General Assembly, he actually said, look where my bill went, talking about the committee assignments, and which is indicative of how it's going to move to the floor. He said, look where my bill went, look where hers went. And I think it's definitely going – that Jeter's bill is probably definitely going to pass the House. And Berger last week didn't really say, I'm never going to let us pass this bill. He said, I don't see a reason to stop the toll plan now. But when you speak with folks like Senator Jeff Tart and other, you know, there's some other Senate Republicans who understand a little bit more nuance of this issue because it's in their backyard. They say they're working to educate their colleagues right now. They're trying to.
Boy, I think they really better be careful with that because just seeing what has happened to Charlotte, like you were intimating before, when, you know, you start getting sausage being made in Raleigh and you've got rural legislators who really love sticking it to Charlotte, we could get stuck with a huge bill on this thing.
What's the legal argument for having Charlotte pick up the tab for this? I've never fully understood that.
Basically that the state is under a contract. They're under a contract and a contractual agreement that literally says if this contract is broken by the state for any reason other than you know for no good reason related to the actual health of the project, just that the state changes its mind.
But it's a DOT contract. It's not a Charlotte
contract.
Yeah,
there is no legal reason. It's all political reason.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we're the classic Dillon rule state, which basically means the General Assembly can stick Charlotte with the tab because they can stick Charlotte with the
tab. Yeah, and the reasoning would be that ultimately the state as a whole was not interested in killing this contract, but you guys wanted it killed. You guys pay the penalty that's in the contract
for
killing it.
And actually almost I hear that.
No, you've got 30 seconds.
Yeah,
go ahead.
You know, because the Charlotte voted to continue to support the toll project in January and the governor dumped it in their lap. So now lawmakers are saying, you could have canceled it then, but since you didn't, now we're not going to bail you out.
The saga goes on and never seems to end. We've got about a year before the roads, I think, actually open. I'm going to figure out what happens. We need to take a quick break. You're listening to the Local News Roundup on WFAE, 90.7 WFAE. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Culture and Heritage Museums, hosting a concert by Iris DeMint, a contemporary folk singer and guest on A Prairie Home Companion, tomorrow at the McKelvey Center, tickets at chmuseums.org/Southern Sound Series. Coming up on Monday on Charlotte Talks, every city has couples who struggle with infertility issues, but Charlotte has been characterized as a small city with big city infertility treatment. Charlotte has become a hub of knowledge in the field of infertility research, and nearly 4,000 people a year in the Queen City seek out treatment. We meet some of the people on the front lines of that research working to help people find answers to what has become recognized as a disease. That's when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. And stay with us. We'll get back to more of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Ted Cruz tries to reboot his campaign by announcing a running mate. Bernie Sanders cut some staff, but he vows to stay in the race until the final primary. And former House Speaker Dennis Hassert is sentenced to prison after admitting to sexually abusing teenage boys.
That's the Diane Rehm Show, ahead from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Tom Bullock, in for Mike Collins, who is dealing with a bout of laryngitis. And with me today are Eric Frazier with the Charlotte Observer, Nick Oxner with WBTV News, Glenn Birkins with the Q-City Metro, and Hillary Burns with the Charlotte Business Journal. And you can, as always, send us your questions and comments on the week's news on Twitter. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup or search for WFAE on Facebook or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. And in this segment of the program, we are going to focus on a victory for Republican lawmakers and infighting in the Republican Party. So let's start with the victory. In 2013, North Carolina's Republican lawmakers passed a sweeping election overhaul law, which cut down on early voting, eliminated same-day registration, and created an ID requirement. The U.S. Justice Department and others sued in federal court. This week, Judge Thomas Schroeder issued his ruling. What was it? Eric.
Well, he basically validated or upheld all of the major provisions of the 2013 law. The opponents, the NAACP and ACLU, all said, we're going to appeal. So it's going to go up to the Fourth Circuit. And, it's on the same trajectory as Amendment 2. Mm-hmm. Amendment 1.
Amendment 1.
I'm trying to combine it with HB 2.
It was the ban on same-sex marriages.
Yeah.
And the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has said they are going to fast-track this appeals process. But let's get into exactly what the basis of the ruling was. One thing that I found is the judge really, really, really went into fine detail on quite a few issues. But one of the main clauses that opponents of the law had, they say it disproportionately impacted African Americans and other minority voters. Now, the judge pointed out that turnout in the 2014 midterms actually increased. Not a huge amount, but it still actually increased. Was that, do you think, a major hit to the clause or to the case?
I've always been fascinated by that argument, in that I think the turnout increase is it's backlash against the 2013 law. You had the NAACP and the Moral Mondays movement all sort of mushroomed out of that as a response to that, and that increase is, I think, largely, if not completely, attributable to all of that activism around the state, registering voters and trying to make people aware that their voting rights are being curtailed.
Plus, there were portions of it that had not taken effect at that point as well.
Yeah.
I actually think that the judge, from a legal standpoint, probably made the right decision. I'm not sure the law is unconstitutional. I don't dispute for a second that it was designed to suppress votes in certain sectors of the population, but simply because of that intent, I'm not sure we can therefore make the argument that it's discriminatory and therefore unconstitutional.
And the raise, what was it, 40.4 to 42, the mm-hmm. difference in African-American participation. And but it seems interesting that he just looked at two very different election cycles and comparing these numbers, and they're not different enough, I think, to make a huge, very strong argument. So I think it's interesting that that was such a pivotal part of his argument in upholding that.
On the other hand, and I didn't read the 400-plus page decision here, but I think the judge's overall point was that no one made a good enough case demonstrating that this actually had a real negative impact. And so he said, well, you can't prove your argument, and so I'm going to go the other way.
And I think it was interesting that he noted that North Carolina had, in a lot of ways, had been out ahead of some other states in terms of progressive voting policies and progressive with a small p.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm.
And that this General Assembly decided to kind of step back from that.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that struck me about the ruling as well is that the federal judge pointed out that North Carolina is now in the mainstream when it comes to what all states, or what a large number of states, I should say, are doing, what's considered now the mainstream. You know, a number of states actually don't have early voting. A number of states, you know, don't let you change or do voter registration on the same day. You know, I'm surprised when you hear that, because you often read about North Carolina's election law, how quickly it was passed and what it did is being this, it very much is a sweeping bill. It was really interesting to me to read the judge laying out that this now is the mainstream. It just basically put North Carolina smack dab in the middle of voting policy.
Well, it is, but I do think there is, I look at states like, Oregon, I think, that passed the motor voter law that basically says that everyone who gets a driver's license is automatically registered to vote. I think there is a small, I think, but real sort of groundswell towards making those types of changes that just sort of make it easier for people to vote rather than harder. Barring any evidence that I have not yet seen that there is actually widespread voter fraud going on in the country, I think that, just from my philosophical standpoint, makes a lot more sense than making it harder when you don't have, you know, actual concrete evidence that there is widespread voter fraud going on, which we don't have.
I agree with you, Eric. I think the winds of time are definitely blowing in that direction. I think voting laws or requirements to vote will become easier with things like motor voter, with the advent of technology. But I think we have to differentiate between the moral argument for making it easier for everyone to vote and the legal argument, which is what I think the judge did. I think, morally speaking, these restrictions are reprehensible, but I'm not sure reprehensible is necessarily illegal.
I mean, given the legal playing field that the Supreme Court had set up when it sort of, you know, cut back on Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, the preclearance rules that were kind of struck down or watered down. Given the playing field, it does seem like legally they're on firm ground.
We've seen these efforts from time to time in U.S. history. You and I, back during my observer days, we worked on a story about Wilmington. Actually, that was really about voters coming together too. Mm-hmm. And as this country becomes more diverse, as the voter rolls become browner, if you will. You know, I think the election of Barack Obama was a wake-up call for Republicans and conservatives, and I think they started flailing around. How can we counter this? And I think as we continue to become a more diverse country, I think we're going to see those efforts again.
Mm-hmm. Again, you can follow the conversation on Twitter by using hashtag WFAE Roundup. You can also send us your questions or comments, or you can search for WFAE on Facebook or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. All right, we've talked about the Republican victory. Let's talk a little bit about Republican infighting. Tomorrow, members of the North Carolina Republican Party's Executive Committee will vote on whether or not to oust their current elected chairman, Hassan Harnett. Now, he's held a post for less than a year. He is a grassroots guy and has been in the midst of a very public fight with the NCGOP establishment brass and the party's executive director, Dallas Woodhouse. So how much of this is just a mirror of the fighting that we're seeing in the Republican Party writ large across the country, and how much of this is more specific to North Carolina?
I think a lot of this is more specific to North Carolina. I mean, it just coincidentally happens to be playing out at the same time as we see the exact same thing happen. I don't know that this is necessarily a clash over ideals. I think that it's really more of a clash over someone that the party didn't really know that well, surprisingly being elected party chairman.
Yeah, they didn't want him to take the post. They actually had, I mean, who was it, the governor, Senator Tom Tillis, basically everybody wanted a different person. Was it Collins?
So. Right. And so, you know, this kind of outsider came in, and the people who've been in the party a long time didn't know this guy. And, you know, do what people normally do when someone they don't know comes to power. They're very skeptical. Now, I think they've had a very surprising reaction to that skepticism. You know, that skepticism has taken a very strange form. But I really think at the heart of this, that's where this bears from.
Given the party's push toward diversity, though, you would think that they would really want to see him succeed and would go out of their way to facilitate that. What happened?
Well, let me fill in the listeners here. For those who don't know, Hassan Harnett is the first African-American chairman of the North Carolina Republican Party. He also his previous experience is somewhat limited for a state party chairman. He was in charge of minority outreach, or at least worked in the minority outreach office for the state Republican Party for a few years. And he also ran much heralded but unsuccessful bid to have a Republican take the 12th congressional district. So now back to Glenn's question.
Yeah, just imagine the political coup or the PR coup of having an African American state party chair in not just a state but a southern state.
Yeah.
Well, it's a very good point. I don't know that there's an easy answer to your question, but I think it's interesting because a very similar thing happened when Dr. Ada Fisher was elected very surprisingly as the North Carolina National Republican Committee woman. Dr. Fisher is also an African American female. She also ran I was at the convention that year when she ran as very much an outsider, and they had this big coronation for the woman who was supposed to win. I mean, setting up her nominating speech was, this woman's so great and she's going to do a great job. And Dr. Fisher nominated herself, stood up there and talked, and everyone said, who is this woman? And then she got elected. And I get the sense that Hassan Harnett is very much got elected the exact same way. I think actually the North Carolina Republican Party is far more diverse than a lot of state Republican parties across the country. But for whatever reason, I think the longtime folks around the party have chosen to focus on the fact that they just don't know this guy. And they don't necessarily agree with what this guy's doing instead of embracing the opportunity for diversity.
But there's some kind of weird details to this story we haven't touched on yet. What is really – I've just been reading about it, but can someone who knows a little more fill in on the email and the hacking of the
– And that is where this story does get very, very different than the national fight in the Republican Party, the national schism really between grassroots and establishment. Hassan Harnett has been accused of trying to asking someone to try to hack the state computer.
Only after he was locked out of his email. State party email account. Yeah. And they tried to – and the Central Committee and the Executive Committee of the state party have – for months now have been censuring him, have been scheming to –
Well, he calls it a witch hunt.
Yeah, and I think if I were an outside observer or the person who was allegedly being hunted, I might use those exact same terms. Now, they say, was it this week, a long list of former GOP chairmen, including Robin Hayes, former congressman who's then GOP chairman, Tom Fetzer, Claude Pope, all of those folks came out and said that this behavior is just not the behavior that you'd expect from a state party chairman. But again, all the stuff that led up to this was you know, this kind of long-term schism and disagreement. And after that, was he locked out of his computer and then may or may not have tried to get someone to hack the party's
computer? Well, and he also brought up race as a motivating factor in a really interesting exchange. You bring up the fact that his email was shut down. He actually wrote from his personal account. Hassan Harnett wrote from his personal account to Dallas Woodhouse, who is a he is the executive director, but that is a paid position. Hassan Harnett actually outranks him. He is the state chairman.
And traditionally, the state chairman has chosen the executive director, and that did not happen in this case.
That's another great point. So Harnett accused Woodhouse of – he said, are you hazing me? Is this some kind of a scheme, or am I just not white enough for you? That pretty much publicly put out there lays out that all of a sudden, at least on one side, if not other sides, that race is playing a role in this whole thing.
Yeah. It's really shocking to see all this unfold the way it has, because on the surface, when he first got elected to that job I had never heard of him either, and so I started kind of researching him, looking him up, and he seems pretty ideologically you know, in line with what the Republican Party wants, like a Ben Carson type conservative. And so it is kind of weird that all this has, you know, sort of just mushroomed into this crazy soap opera that it's turned into. And usually that was the state Democratic Party. Yeah, so those guys are sitting on the other side probably going, finally, you know, you guys implode too. Great.
And here's an interesting point to make. When you call Harna the grassroots and you implicitly, you know, then say that the Central Committee and the rest of the party must not be the grassroots. But from someone who's been around the Republican Party in North Carolina for nearly 10 years now, let me tell you that the folks who are running the party now and the folks who are trying to get Hassan Harnett out are traditionally the people who have been the grassroots and not the establishment. Dallas Woodhouse, for a long time, worked for Americans for Prosperity and worked on groups backed by Art Pope and the Koch brothers. Okay, some of the central leaders here on the key leaders on the Central Committee and the Executive Committee, folks like Joyce Cotton and Zan Bunn, longtime grassroots people. These are not, you know, where you look at the national level and you see Donald Trump versus, well, or, you know, or Ted Cruz.
But that's the fun twist when it comes to politics this year, is if you are a longtime grassroots anybody in the Republican Party, you are inherently seen as the establishment.
That's true, but there's still a big difference between John Boehner going up against Ted Cruz and, you know, Dallas Woodhouse going up against Hassan Harnett, because these are people that very much – and you're right. To your point, you are very right. But these are people who are very, very much based in the grassroots, very ideologically similar, very conservative with big and small Cs, you know, in every way you can think about it. And so it's fascinating to me that now they've become the establishment, and that's just as what has happened all across the country.
I guess my question – now is the damage too big or too much that he can stay, for him to stay, because the culture has been damaged? Because once words like that are said, I know, at least covering business in a business setting, that culture is damaged. So I don't know, that would take some serious work to come back from that. So I don't know whoever's fault it is, despite whose fault it is, if he should stay or not.
That's a great question. I mean, do we think that he can survive this? He does have popular support. But the executive committee, and I say popular support because he was popularly elected, so let's assume that that's the standard. The executive committee, it's what, 550-some Republicans. It is not the party overall. It is not the same body that elected Harnett in the first place. Do we think he has a chance to survive?
Well, remember, too, there was a campaign underway to get all the state lawmakers, Republican lawmakers who are a member of the executive committee by virtue of their office, to try to get them to the convention this weekend. There was a kerfuffle around the convention, by the way, and how much it would cost to go to the convention, where Harnett had gotten elected on a platform of lowering the fees. The Central Committee came out and said, nope, the fees are going to be higher than what he promised. He then unilaterally lowered them. But back to your question.
And now they're back up to the $90 that the Central Committee.
That's exactly right. But back to your question, the executive committee, you know, people are trying to get some of the more what you would call quote unquote establishment folks to come out to this. But I read somewhere this week that in caucus from a reliable place, I just don't remember where, that the Republican caucus in the state house was going to have a meeting to decide whether or not they even want to wade into this. And do they, when you have a short session, do they want to get involved in this?
And an election year.
That's right.
I mean, that's the thing, is Harnett does have his supporters. One other thing I want to bring up here. Actually, you know what? I think we're going to need to wait for the break. We've got about 30 seconds, and it's a bit of a tough one. I won't drop that one on you guys in the last second. Again, you're listening to the Friday News Roundup here on Charlotte Talks. Send us your thoughts. Drop us a tweet. We're at hashtag WFAE Roundup, or search us on WFAE or on Facebook, or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. We'll be right back with not just politics. We're going to get into some business and the Hornets. Stay tuned.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Isiola Lodge at Linville Golf Club, featuring local, fresh cuisine, a Donald Ross Championship golf course, fly fishing, and spa. Located off the Blue Ridge Parkway, information at isiola.com. Coming up in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup continues. Ted Cruz tries to reboot his campaign by announcing a running mate. Bernie Sanders begins cutting staff, but vows to stay in the race until the final primary in June. And former House Speaker Dennis Hastert is sentenced to prison after admitting he sexually abused teenage boys. A panel of journalists joins guest host Susan Page for analysis of the week's top national news stories. Stay tuned for that on the Diane Rehm Show ahead at 10 o'clock. And we're getting right back to the Charlotte News Roundup on Charlotte Talks in just a moment. Stay with us.
Joe Klosik, owner of the Corkscrew Wine Shop, a WFAE underwriter.
You have the diversity in your programming and the diversity of the folks that listen. And those folks that listen come to our shop. When we chose to underwrite with WFAE, that was part of our identity, part of our brand. I would say it was one of the best decisions we ever made.
Find out more. Email underwriting at WFAE.org for details.
This is Charlotte Talks, our local news roundup here on WFAE. I'm Tom Bullock. And with me, as always, Eric Frazier with the Charlotte Observer. And today we've got Nick Oxner with WBTV News, Glenn Birkins with Q City Metro, and Hillary Burns with the Charlotte Business Journal. One last question before we move on away from politics into business and sport. One of the more controversial things that Hassan Harnett, the chairman, the embattled chairman of the North Carolina Republican Party, has done is call the fee to go to the state convention, basically the cost of buying a ticket to go to the state convention. He called it a poll tax. You know, in the South, that's obviously pretty charged language. And the reason he said that is because in order to vote for delegates to go to the National Republican Convention, you first have to buy a ticket. That $90 fee, a lot of people complain, is just far too high. I'm curious your thoughts. Is it a fair comparison to call those tickets a poll tax, Glenn?
No, it's not. That's a little hyperbolic. Parties all over the country traditionally set their own rules, and you might argue that it's too high, too low, but to compare it with a poll tax that actually disenfranchised large numbers of voters, I think, is a stretch.
All right. So, other things happened this week, believe it or not, besides the General Assembly, politics, and infighting. And one of those was with Bank of America. They held their shareholders meeting here in Charlotte this week. Those things can sometimes be a little bit raucous. Hillary, I know you were there. What were the big headlines out of that meeting?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was my first annual shareholder meeting at Bank of America. I was there covering it. And I had heard from my predecessor that to watch out for picketing and protesters and crazy people inside asking the executives all kinds of questions. And there were no protests or anything outside this year. But it was still interesting inside. The main thing that came out of it is they voted for a new board director. And all of the management proposals passed this year. One interesting thing, a 15-year-old stood up in the meeting who is a shareholder and asked Brian Moynihan about why the stock wasn't performing better. And
Brian Moynihan, obviously the chairman and CEO of a Fortune 50 company? One of the largest banks on the planet. Mm-hmm. So this 15-year-old decides to question and?
And apparently she asked a question last year, too, about women's pay. And she told the CEO who attended Notre Dame that she would like to go to Notre Dame. She wanted to know why she wasn't making more money off of her share prices. And Brian Moynihan explained to her, as he did to many other shareholders in attendance, that they were working on it. They are focused on steady growth, and they don't have all of the legacy problems that they used to have. It's becoming a more normalized company.
And really what you're saying there is business code for they've settled a whole bunch of legal cases when it came to bad mortgages and all
yes,
sorts of stuff.
Exactly.
Now, I think what she was getting at too, which is really interesting, is didn't she kind of chide him for the efficiencies in the bank?
Yes.
This is not what I expect a 15-year-old to be asking.
Yeah, she was very poised and she knew what she was talking about. It was interesting. I think that she was making the PR people in the room really nervous. I saw them all getting a little antsy. But she did a good job, and he answered her in a straightforward manner. There was one analyst there, Mike Mayo, who's a very outspoken analyst. I'm sure you see him in headlines all the time. He jumped up about three times, and at the last time he jumped up, he said, Mr. Moynihan, I wanted to let you know I was having fun at your little tech expo you had outside to show off digital tools and whatnot that the bank had been working on. And the CEO looked at him and said, if you have a thumb, you can use it, referring to the cardless ATM that you can just use your thumbprint. So I think he was getting a little annoyed with him, but it was pretty not as eventful as in the past.
Now, first quarter earnings also came out. Any headlines from that for Bank of America?
Yeah, they were down a little bit from last quarter, but as analysts I talked to said, it's becoming a more normal company. We're not seeing these big one-time fees from legal issues and whatnot, so it's good for Charlotte.
All right. And Nick, I want to turn to you for a story that you're going to have on tonight, I believe.
Yes, tonight at 6.
So we've got Tim Moore. Everybody knows him as the Speaker of the North Carolina House, but that is a part-time job officially. You're looking into another role that he plays, which is the attorney for Cleveland County. What's the story here?
Yeah, the story is that Tim Moore was hired last July, as the Cleveland County attorney, they decided to kind of abruptly fire their longtime Cleveland County attorney who'd been serving in that particular stint 14 years, and they replaced him with Tim Moore. After that happened, the county attorney who'd been shown the door wrote this letter kind of questioning the circumstances behind the speaker's hiring. The Raleigh News and Observer did two stories on this, and in there, both Speaker Moore and the chairman of the Cleveland County Commission, Jason Falls, who is the first cousin once removed of the speaker, both said, you know, and I'm not going to use exact quotes, but roughly said, look, we approached Tim Moore about this job. We had an opening. We were Tim Moore told the Newsman Observer's Colin Campbell they had an opening. The board did, and they came to me, and I was happy to fill it. Well, that letter came out from his predecessor saying that no, he had been gunning for the job, and this is just politics. And of course, they said no, that's not true. Well, I obtained a text message from Tim Moore to a county one of the county commissioners from 6 months before he was hired, in which he 4 months before he was hired, in which he said, I would like the county attorney job if it were open, which kind of pokes some holes in the party line that no, we approached him about it.
So what exactly does this position do? What is a county attorney in charge of?
Well, you're the lawyer for the county, and there are lots of things, you know, looking over contracts, representing the county, any lawsuits that might come up. If you're in Union County, it's a very busy job. So he's their lawyer. And an interesting thing to point out is that the previous county attorney you get an annual retainer. In Cleveland County, they hire someone from an outside firm, basically, as their county attorney. And this contract is between Tim Moore, the person, not Tim Moore, the law firm, and Cleveland County, right? So you have – he's making a $25,000 retainer and then is billing at $250 an hour for work that he does for Cleveland County. That's slightly more both in yearly retainer and hourly billing than his predecessor. And then he's supposed to attend all of the meetings of the county commissioners and of the Board of Health. He has about an 80% attendance rating at the county commissioner meeting. The Board of Health meeting, he's been to one since he was hired last July. And instead – in his place, he's sending an associate from his law firm. And so I asked him, is the contract between you, the county, and your law firm, or the county and you? The contract's between him and the county and not his law firm. But he claims that this is a quote, when you hire me, you hire my law firm. And so that's why he says that it's okay for him to send associates in his stead.
So you've got the Speaker of the House who's also representing a county. Are there any conflicts of interest here?
Well, the Speaker last year told the News and Observer that he had it cleared by the ethics office and that they said it would be fine so long as he recused himself when, you know, issues of state funding and whatnot, when his two jobs conflicted. So I think right now, in the time-wise, we'll see how many meetings he can get to. I mean, we just started the session. The Board of Commissioners meets on Tuesday nights, and so we'll see how many times. He does have an assistant county attorney that is a county employee now, but we'll see how many meetings he can get to.
All right. Now to the playoffs. Tonight, our Charlotte Hornets could do something they haven't done in 14 years, win a playoff series. The last time they did it, Jamal Mashburn and Baron Davis. Remember those guys?
No.
They were on the team. All right. So tonight, the Hornets play the Miami Heat. Now, Wednesday night, I have to be honest, I thought something crazy was going on because I heard in my house yelling and screaming from my neighbors. If I wasn't watching the game Wednesday night, I would think I was back in Baltimore. It was so loud. It was amazing.
Wow. That's music to Michael Jordan's ears.
It absolutely is. And the yelling and screaming was because Courtney Lee hit a nearly last-second shot to basically give the Hornets a two-point lead and eventually win the game. Now, here is what Courtney Lee said after the game.
Yeah, it was an emotional roller coaster, man, because throughout the night, I think I was 1-for-8 before I hit that shot, and I had that layup, and it was a close call. The refs didn't see it as a go 10, so it was a play on, and so just wanted to help my team any way that I can. So I crashed the glass, got the offensive rebound. I'm not sure who it was. I think it was Jeremy that passed the ball back to me. I was wide open, and I just let it fly. And so, I mean, if I had to draw it up, I'll take shooting 1-for-8 before I knock down a big shot any day.
The only time you're going to hear a professional basketball player say 1-for-8's good as long as I get that shot.
That's a very confident man.
Plus, there was another piece of that where he said that he was somehow helped or propelled to this by a Bible study session with his masseuse during a massage, that somehow that helped him get his mind right. And I was like, okay, there's an interesting pre-game prep.
Hey, yeah, I'll tell you what, if they win the championship, he can open a whole chain of massage Bible class outlets in NBA cities. So seriously, what – they were 0-2. They were dead in the water.
Just 0-2, like really ugly losses 0-2.
Exactly. Yeah. Like Charlotte was thinking, well, you know what? We made the playoffs again. That's it. What happened? How did they battle back?
I think Steve Clifford deserves a lot of credit. Steve? Yeah, that is his first name. The coach of the Hornets. the coach, because he did some adjustments after those first two games. And I think he's out coaching Eric Spoelstra, the Heat coach. He went bigger with his lineup, and it seems like the Heat have been struggling to kind of deal with that. I think also the players have just been attacking more. Kemba Walker and Jeremy Lin going to the basket a lot more, and they've been struggling with that too. So
there are people who know a whole lot more about basketball than I do, who actually gave the Hornets a good chance of winning this one at the onset. They actually thought they would win it.
Yeah, I thought they would. I mean, when you look at their record toward the end of the season, the Hornets were one of the hottest teams in the NBA. So I was actually surprised when they came out and laid, you know, two eggs in the first two games, because I thought they were going to take the Heat.
And
so,
I think they lost one of those games by 10 points. I mean, they
one by 30 points.
Yeah, one by 30.
I mean, I'm sorry, 30, you're right.
Yeah, these aren't just small losses. This was like, whoa, where'd the Hornets that we just had seen for the last month or two, where'd they vanish to? But it's cool that to see if we get the same momentum out of the Hornets in their playoff run that we saw out of the Panthers. I was talking to folks in Raleigh this week, and how about those Hornets? I mean, so, you know, it's fun to see what this might do for yet another Charlotte sports team, which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So what does it do in this city? I obviously wasn't here way back in the day, the last time we won a playoff series. Big deal here? I mean, everybody loves to say that they love the Hornets, but I'll tell you, you can tell a great sports city by how they react in these kinds of situations. What are we going to see in Charlotte?
Well, I think the last really big Hornets moment that I remember was not actually the win with Baron Davis and those guys, but when Alonzo Mourning hit that shot. I think it was against Boston to win. It was like a last minute shot, the last shot of the game, the winning shot, and I just remember the crowd in then, I guess it was the arena over off Tivola, just exploding into just. You know, just like everybody lost their minds. And it sort of symbolized how, at that point, the city was just really in love with this team. The Hornets were our first, you know, professional sports team. Mm-hmm. It was the first team that we sort of, you know, embraced. And, you know, I think there's a reason why you saw, like, Hornets paraphernalia flying off the shelves when Michael Jordan finally got the name back and put the same color scheme back on the table. People are still in love with that team from you know, the memories that they have back then. It's going to take a while to build back to that level, but it's a lot of good memories.
Yeah. I think it was Hugh McCall who said after one of the Panthers wins, maybe after they were going to the Super Bowl, that we don't have to put North Carolina in front of the name Charlotte anymore. And I think on a national level, sports team victories do that kind of thing for cities. They kind of put them on the map and help define those cities.
Yeah.
Well, one final thing I do want to get to. We learned yesterday, actually, that Charlotte City Councilwoman Claire Fallon says that she is stepping down. She is going to finish her term, which runs through 2017. Fallon can be a bit of a controversial political figure here in Charlotte. Do we know exactly why she's stepping down?
Well, she what she has said is just that she feels stymied by the lack of the progress as she would see it on the city council. She's often been sort of kind of a lone wolf vote among the Democrats, and she's kind of, you know, she goes her own way, and she has her own thoughts, her own opinions, and she's not afraid to share them. And She's 81, so I guess there's been some speculation that maybe she's just kind of, you know, not wanting to deal with all that anymore. But she says it's not really an age thing. It's more of a frustration, political frustration thing, that she has very specific ideas about what she thinks should happen, and she's not often in the majority about that.
And if you remember, right after the, you know, the hubbub and the closed session on the fire chief and how that was mm-hmm. handled, she attended the closed session and then she left, and she was not there for the city council meeting. And I called her as she was leaving to ask why. And this, she said, quote, "I can't stand to look at them," meaning her fellow city council members, anymore tonight. And so, you know, clearly she's just frustrated with her colleagues. I think she feels, unwelcome anymore is probably a nice way to put it. And so this isn't surprising at all. It'll be unfortunate to see her go because, for better or for worse, she made council meetings entertaining and just covering council entertaining.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. Now, she's a Democrat. She also sided with Republicans on a number of key votes, including, I think she voted against the LGBT ordinance this last round.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Am I correct in that?
I think you're right.
She did, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what has her impact here been as a Democrat fighting against other Democrats?
No, keeping people honest.
Eric?
Well, I think she has been a useful voice. I think we on the editorial board at The Observer endorsed her the last time because, you know, she keeps people honest. You know?
All right, fair enough.
Didn't make her popular, but she's good to have around.
Well, that is the voice of Eric Frazier with the Charlotte Observer. Also joining us for the roundup this week, Nick Oxner with WBTV, Glenn Birkins with Q-City Metro, and Hillary Burns with the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we've got Diane Rehm coming up with the National News Roundup next. You're listening to 90.7 WFAE.